Trinity Forum Conversations. I'm Cherie Harder, the president of the Trinity Forum, and with me today is Andy Crouch. Andy is the author of the book Culture Making, Recovering Our Creative Calling, which won Christianity Today's 2009 Book Award, as well as being named one of the best books of 2008 by Publishers Weekly, Relevant, Outreach, and Leadership. Last year, he became the executive editor of Christianity Today, in addition to his service on the board of Fuller Theological Seminary and the Equitas Group, and as a senior fellow of the International Justice Mission. Andy's newest book is a profound work entitled Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power, published by InterVarsity Press, which we invited him here today to discuss. Andy, great to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So this was a fascinating book. And you directly challenge what seems to be a fairly common assumption about power, articulated in part by Nietzsche and Foucault, that power is essentially zero sum. It's
yes.
One person, the Superman, expanding their dominion at other people's expense, and generally either backed by or rooted in the threat of force. But you argue that the deepest form of power is not coercion, but creation. What does that mean, practically speaking?
Yes, you know, this idea that the realest kind of power is when you can make someone do something they don't want to do, so you win and they lose, has a long history, maybe going all the way back to the third chapter of Genesis. But if you go further back than the third chapter of Genesis, of course, you get to the first two chapters. And here you have a story of an infinitely powerful being, let's say, who actually is able to bring into being something that was not. And in order to understand that story of creation, you have to realize that when other ancient people in the ancient Near East told their creation myths, they were all stories of violence. They were stories about how one god triumphed over another god, or one group of gods triumphed over another group of gods. Always about coercion, always about actually zero-sum power. The writers of the Bible tell this story that says there's a deeper power, and it's the power to say, let there be something that there wasn't. Now, human beings obviously don't have the ability to bring things into being absolutely out of nothing, but when I started to reflect on what are the most remarkable uses of power, it's amazing how often they involve the creation of things that haven't existed. So the whole history of technology is bringing into the realm of possibility for human beings things that they couldn't do before. There's real additive or multiplicative abilities added to the human race over time. And then, of course, you think about, at a much more intimate level, the kind of power that parents exercise. And parents do have to coerce, and I definitely had to make my kids do things they didn't want to at a couple points. But mostly parenting is not about coercion. It's about helping this young person flourish. And I've come to believe that that's a deeper form of power than just the ability to make someone do something that they don't want to do.
Is that intuitively a hard thing to persuade people of? I mean, it seems like it would be hard to persuade North Koreans, for example, that the power of creativity trumps coercive power.
Well, I think in a way every human being is set up to believe this is not the case, that in fact, yeah, the realest form of power is coercion, because we do live in a fallen world. At the same time, we see the effects when people only have coercion to rely on. It is profoundly unproductive, if you could put it that way. Now, if you live truly within the grip of the North Korean regime, it may be very hard for you to get a full perspective on this. But if you live, as most of us are fortunate to do, out of the grip of that regime, you see that when people in power can only rely on coercion, the result is diminishment. Economic diminishment, cultural diminishment, the kind of banal and boring nature of life in these states that are run by sort of dictators who concentrate power. On the other hand, when you have healthier political systems, which certainly involve coercion but are not limited to that, you see much more flourishing. So, yeah, I think we're all suspicious of this. And, you know, the number one thing I've heard when I tell people I'm writing a book about power is they quote Lord Acton to me and they say, oh, yes, power corrupts. Like, everybody knows that. And it's true. Power does corrupt. But it's not totally true. Because, you know, the second part of what Lord Acton said was absolute power corrupts absolutely. But all of us were once at the mercy of someone, or perhaps two people, who had absolute power over us when we were babies. Someone had absolute power for all practical purposes, but they were not absolutely corrupted by it. If they'd been absolutely corrupted, none of us would have made it to age 3. And yet here we are, and many of us were fortunate enough to have parents who were not perfect, but did use their power reasonably well, were not corrupted by it, and we would, should trace a great deal of our own flourishing to the fact that they did use their power.
Mm-hmm. Is coercive power always corrupting?
Well, I would say coercive power is always dangerous, but that's actually true of all, that's true of creative power as well. Coercive power has particular temptations. Because if I have it, if I can make people do it, then it's actually a very tempting shortcut to get what I want. Now, sometimes coercion, that is forcing someone to do something, or perhaps even more often restraining someone from doing something that would be harmful, sometimes it's very necessary for flourishing. And even in the account of creation that we get from Genesis 1, you see God pushing the waters aside so that land can emerge. God is actually kind of pushing some things around, pushing, for that matter, in the biblical cosmology, the heavens above from the earth below. This makes room for more kinds of life. But there is a kind of forcefulness about what God does, I think. But what's dangerous about it is when we use it as a substitute for more difficult kinds of power that don't work as quickly, but actually would produce much better results. So any given day, it's easier for me to just order my kids to clean their rooms. And some days I have to do that. But if I'm really to contribute to my children's flourishing, I'm going to have to find a way to work with them so that they eventually truly want to clean their room and they don't just do it because I make them. Because if I always have to make them, they're missing out, and actually I'm missing out.
You open the book by saying that power is a gift, which is a different way of describing power. Mm-hmm. And if it is a gift, what are the hallmarks of wise stewardship of the gift?
Yeah. Well, I would say the first, perhaps, would be relationship. It's so interesting that in this original creation story, the story of God's power, when it comes to the climax of the story in the sixth day, God switches from the singular, or really kind of an impersonal, let there be, to this very personal and plural, let us make human beings, plural, male and female, in our image. Think about that shift from just what you might imagine as this sole, solitary creator that you've seen in the first 6 days, and you suddenly realize, well, wait a minute, this God who has been speaking into existence is actually not singular, is not a monad, but actually there is already an us there. Such an astonishing thing in the founding text of monotheism to have that plural. And then this God, when God creates human beings in his image, they're male and female. There's this requirement that there be more than one to fully image God. And they're not just two of a kind. There's real difference that's going to lead to real relationship, because real relationship happens when you're different from me, but I recognize something in you that I need. So I think the hallmark of power used well is it leads to deeper and deeper relationships. The hallmark of power abused is it diminishes relationship. And then I'd say the second mark is flourishing. When power is used well, things become everything they were meant to be. And there's more being in the world, there's more capacity in the world, there's actually more power in the world when power is used well. When an employer uses his or her power well, the employees in that organization actually find that they can do more than they were able to do before. You add to the capacity of human power. So true power is relational, and true power multiplies. And very quickly, I'd say the third thing that we get from the Genesis account is vulnerability. That true power is not invulnerable. The man and the woman who image God are naked. They are very much in need of one another, in need of God, in need of protection. And true power is actually not the opposite of vulnerability. It includes a kind of an openness to suffering in the world and with the world.
If power is such a gift and has the potential for so much flourishing, should we be seeking it?
Well, in a way, we've already been given more than we know what to do with. Human being, you know, the psalmist looks up at the heavens and says, I look at the moon and the stars that you've made, and what are human beings that you're mindful of us? But then the psalmist goes on to say, but you have given human beings authority over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air. He has this long list of things in the created world that human beings have been given a power over. So the first thing I think we need to do is not actually think that power is something we have to go grasp, that has to be sort of wrested or grabbed from a reluctant world or a reluctant God. In fact, our Creator has given us tremendous power as human beings. And the dignity of every human being is the dignity of image bearing. Now, in the world as we have it, the world that is fallen and is broken, power is not distributed properly. It is, we don't experience it in the full richness and blessing that it's meant to be. And so in a limited way, I think we could say, yes, we need to be on a quest to develop and receive the right kind of power. I'm very worried whenever people start striving for anything, striving for love, striving for acceptance, and striving for power, striving for money, but to open ourselves, to become the kind of people who could handle the power that is actually ours by birthright, I think we should pursue that.
You mentioned image bearing a little bit earlier. Tell us more what you mean by that.
I started to feel that the deepest biblical category for understanding power was this idea of the image, that human beings are made in the image of God. It is by virtue of our image bearing that we have the extraordinary power we have. Out of all the creatures in the world, there are astonishing creatures. There are many creatures with more strength. There are many creatures that are faster than we are. They are exquisitely adapted to their environments in ways that we're not. And yet, human beings have this incredible ability to reshape our environment, to adapt to our environment, to work together to transform our environment. And the biblical view of this is that that's because we're made in the image of God in a way that the rest of creation is not. The rest of creation is good and is valued, but it's not made in the image of God. But the other thing about image bearing is it actually gives us a way to understand how power goes wrong. And that is that human beings who themselves are supposed to be the image of God have actually made false images, what the Bible calls idols. An idol is an image that purports to represent God, but actually misrepresents God. And the biblical story, in a way, is of the ones who are meant to wield their power for flourishing as image bearers of God, instead conceding their power to these things they make, which we call idols, that take the place of God and actually end up exploiting and abusing people. Every idol exploits. And so the image both helps us understand what power was meant to be. It was meant to reflect the Creator's power, but it also tells us what's gone wrong, the making of false images.
In your book, you very explicitly connect injustice and idolatry. And I believe you even assert that injustice basically comes out of idolatry, is rooted in it.
Yes.
What do you see as the connection between the two?
You know, it's interesting. In the Hebrew Bible in particular, there are really just two things that over and over God is said to hate. God hates idolatry, hates these false gods that we make, these God substitutes, and God hates injustice, the abuse and the exploitation of persons in particular. And as I probed this, I started to realize what these have in common is they both involve the degradation of the image of God. And in injustice, it's most clear in the way that the victims of injustice have the image of God effaced or erased. So when one is a victim of oppression, part of what happens in an unjust situation is the victims of oppression lose their ability to have proper image-bearing authority and dominion over their part of the world. You know, the most dramatic form of injustice in many ways is slavery. And what slavery involves is the robbing of people of their proper dignity as people who work and are properly paid, as people who have relationships that are not under the control of their employer or their owner. And all of these image-bearing qualities are stripped away. And so I think the reason God hates injustice the way God hates idolatry is that both of them lead to the loss of the image of God in the world. And by the way, in injustice, it's not just that the oppressed the victims of injustice end up losing the image of God, but the oppressor, the perpetrator of injustice, ends up actually playing a false god as well. They do not use their power for flourishing. They don't use it for relationship. They use it just for their own benefit. And so they become kind of a false image of God themselves. They become like a living, talking, walking idol that everyone looks and says, well, that's real power. But it's actually a great misrepresentation of what power was meant to be.
Unfortunately, there are so many examples of in history, and even going on now, where Christians have defended what seems to be clear oppression or domination using scripture to justify it. You know, we know there was an entire denomination that split over slavery in America. The very unequal status of men and women has been defended often by invoking the Bible. How can we as Christians think more Christianly about what proper image bearing means?
I think there are two places we need to go. In a way, we need to go to the bookends of the story, the original purpose of power and of human beings, and their ultimate destiny, this glorious destiny of Revelation 21. And then we need to go to the center of the story, which for Christians is the cross. And the cross really complicates your life, if I can put it this way. When you take on board that all the powers of Jesus' day, both religious and political, conspired to take the Son of God, the true image bearer, and eradicate him, attempt to eradicate him and his message. And the cross should leave all of us aghast at what human beings are capable of doing. In the name of religion, in the name of politics, in the name of, you know, sort of safety and order. You know, Paul has this interesting thing he says in Colossians or Ephesians, where he talks about how the cross unmasked the principalities and powers, these kind of big world-scale demonic powers that kind of govern human history. And at the cross, you discover that the world is not neat and tidy and does not just work like a clock. It's got this deep brokenness at the heart of it. Ideally, all of us who are Christians would be so chastened by that that we would not underwrite these idolatrous forms of power. But what happens is you get what Luther called a theology of glory, which avoids the cross. As opposed to a theology of the cross, you get this idea that everything's pretty much okay and getting better. And, you know, it's interesting how much of Christian underwriting of great injustice has been in the name of progress, has been in the name of kind of social order. And the cross really complicates all that. So there's no formula for avoiding being complicit in these things. But I think if we paid more attention to the cross, we'd be maybe a little safer with the power that we have.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the relationship between love and power. You talked in your book about how love really transfigures power and is one of the antidotes to Lord Acton's dictum. And I think some of the examples you gave were primarily along the lines of a parent's love and love for and power over their children. And yet, everywhere you look, you can see lots of sort of sad counterexamples, people struggling to make sense of the dysfunctional relationships they had with their parents who undeniably loved them. But their love didn't transfigure their desire to control them, even inappropriately, and even into their adulthood. And on the very far, much more frightening and pathological end of that spectrum could also be instances of domestic abuse. Relationships that started out loving, that were committed, and yet have gone terribly awry. In the hope that we share that love transfigures power, what do you make of the fact that so often it doesn't?
There's no thing, even very good things, that are safe apart from God. And there's no thing, and not even very good things, that cannot be turned into a substitute for God. So what happens, I think, when love, which begins so good, becomes underwrites or gives rise to terrible things, is that love has become an idol. It's become something that people cherish without cherishing it in the proper relationship to the only one who really is love, who really is good, who really is worth cherishing, and it becomes a substitute. And, you know, I think abuse, by the way, every idol ends up abusing its worshipers. Every idol gets more and more exploitative over time. And abuse in relationships is in many ways the result of disappointed God players, people who tried to take the place of God or wanted this other person in their lives to sort of play God for them. And when they don't do what we want, don't behave in the way we expect, we become more and more manipulative and ultimately actually violent in trying to extract what we want. And what's been lost sight of there is continual kind of conversion conversion to and dependence on God, who is not like idols and doesn't drive bargains and doesn't give lots of benefits up front, but then extract a lot at the end. And you know, love is maybe the best thing. It's the one thing that Paul says is going to last forever. But love apart from God is just one more idol, and it really ends up not being love at all. It ends up being some, you know, lust or covetousness or the desire to possess and control. And that happens when we get out of relationship with the only one who really can give us what we want.
What's the difference between power and privilege?
This is very important for many of us to come to grips with. In a word, I would say privilege is unconscious power. Privilege is all the forms of power that come to me not because I'm currently engaged in a risky act of creating or engaged in some act of real responsiveness to the world. Like you and I are doing now, we're having this conversation, and each of us is exercising power. You're trying to exercise your power through asking really good questions. I'm trying to respond, and we're very conscious of that. But there are all these other kinds of power we carry with us that we are not conscious of, and we're not consciously exercising at a given moment in the day. But they are still power. And that's very dangerous because we do not live in the unfallen world where all power led to flourishing. We instead live in this world where we are constantly tempted to start relying on our own power rather than relying on God to protect us, to provide the things we want. And privilege is this incredible resource that often can provide you a lot of things human beings want, such as security, the sort of assumed respect of other people. So as a white man in America, I have the privilege both of my skin color and my gender. And I can assume when I walk into a store that the security guard is there to protect me. Obviously to protect the store, but he's there or she's there, you know, a position that serves my flourishing. My friends who are not white, who have the same education I do, or better educations, higher status occupations, but walk into those same stores, often have very different encounters with these security guards, who do not treat them as the people they're there to serve, but actually as the people that they are trying to catch. And what I have in the form of my racial privilege is this store of unexamined power that, if I'm not very careful, becomes just something that I use for my own protection and benefit rather than for others' flourishing.
And how can Christians become careful about that? You know, it's often hard to recognize, much less renounce, that which is in one's own self-interest.
And a lot of privilege you can't even renounce. I could, you know, as a holder of a U.S. passport, I have tremendous privilege. All this power that comes kind of along with that blue passport. I could renounce that passport. I could give up my citizenship. I cannot give up the fact that I learned English as a child and speak it natively, fluently. That's privilege. I can't get rid of it. So what do we do with this stuff we can't get rid of? I think the first thing to do is to, if I could put it this way, yoke ourselves, connect ourselves in relationship with people who do not have the same privileges we have, and put ourselves in places where we will become conscious of our privilege. Because then you can start to actually assess how you're using it. As long as it's unconscious, you will never know what you have. But if you are in relationship with people who can say, hey, you got to walk into that store and the security guard didn't ask anything, now I become aware of that. And then the second question is, how do I use it well? And how do I be careful with it, as you said? And I don't know any easy answer to that, except that I think I need to be constantly asking, how could I put this at risk for someone's benefit, for the benefit of flourishing? Because all true creative power involves some amount of risk. And so it's very appropriate to ask, with my privilege, what could I risk this on? A very quick example. I wrote a book called Culture Making that did pretty well. That was an exercise of power. But all the benefits that come after that are privilege. So what you do in the publishing world when you have a successful book is you write all these knockoff books. You know, so I wrote Culture Making, so then we write a recipe book and call it Culture Baking, and you could do all these line extensions, and that would be a way to just cash in. But instead I decided I need to take all this kind of cultural capital I have and write a more risky book. I need to write a more difficult book, one that maybe has less chance of commercial success, but that I feel really called to write. So I'm called to kind of take all those that resources and put it down on the table on a bet that calls me to greater dependence on God. And I think, in a way, that's the story of a life of privilege, is ever more risky ventures with whatever God has given us or just culture has given us.
One of the things I thought was interesting about your book, too, is that you provide a defense of institutions, even advocacy for institutions.
Yes.
And often, institutions are associated more with privilege as
right.
opposed to creative power. What does it mean to rethink and redeem power institutionally?
Yeah, we are very quick to dismiss institutions or to be cynical about institutions, I think, in these latter days. I mean, you look at the approval ratings for many of the institutions of our society, and they're incredibly low. People are very reluctant to trust that these large-scale patterns can do anything helpful. However, if flourishing is meant to spread through the whole world, God says to his image bearers, be fruitful and multiplying, that is going to require cultural patterns that can multiply. And institution is just a name we give to things that can spread out and be realized in many different places, or can be multiplied both over through space, across space, and through time, can be handed on through time. And actually, I think if the only kind of flourishing we could create would be a kind that would just exist for an instant in this moment that we're here on the planet, and then it disappeared, that's actually not very deep flourishing. Compared to, could we build something that would actually hand on the capacity to flourish in some way from generation to generation? And when you successfully do that for three generations or more, you have what a sociologist would call an institution, a pattern of flourishing that's handed on. Now, obviously, we all know these things get very stilted. They become institutionalist. They kind of get very devoted to their own preservation. But I try to make the case in the book that actually, if you really care about flourishing, you want to create environments where lots and lots of people can flourish, and where people can flourish over multiple generations. And to do that, I think you have to invest in institutions.
That's great. And it is going to be many people who won't have the opportunity to read your book, even though they should. If you had the chance to basically sort of sum up the most important takeaway from your book for those folks, how would you do it?
It would be probably two questions. Well, let me make it three questions. Where do you have some measure of power? And this requires a level of honesty. We'd all rather not admit what we have. But where do you have some measure of power in your vocation or profession, in your family, in your neighborhood? Secondly, how is that power leading to flourishing? Who is flourishing because you have power? I think that's the most important question any of us can ask about our power. Who's flourishing because I have it? And I hope the answer isn't just me, right? And then the third question is, whose image are you bearing in the world? The title of the book is Playing God. And the kind of punchline of the book is all of us are playing some God. We're all playing some picture of what we think ultimate reality is. We're all bearing an image. Whose image are you bearing? And if I ask the people over whom you have power in your life, does Cherie or Andy look like the true God, or do they, in the way they use power, look like or image another God? What would those people say? The way we use our power shows what we believe is ultimately true about the world and who is ultimately the most powerful one in the world.
Thanks, Andy. Great talking with you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to an interview with thought leader Andy Crouch, the author of Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. Our mission at the Trinity Forum is to provide a space and resources for leaders to engage life's greatest questions in the context of faith and provide a platform for the best of Christian thought leadership through publications and programs such as this conversation. As a member of the Trinity Forum Society, you are a vital part of realizing that mission, and we offer this podcast interview as both a benefit of your membership and in gratitude for your involvement. Thank you for joining us.